Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Cigar Stream. This will be the first in what I hope to be a quite long-running mini-series here, where I'm going to be reviewing the entire back catalogue of Adam Curtis, starting all the way back in 1988 with An Ocean Apart. We'll get back to that in a moment. I will just like to remind everybody before we get going, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. The best-selling course by far is the Trivium, that is Foundations of Writing, Foundations of Logic, and Foundations of Rhetoric. Here's a video, and when I come back, we're going to be reviewing An Ocean's Apart, Episode 1 and 2 by Adam Curtis.
Academic Agency.
So before I begin, who is Adam Curtis? Is one question to ask, I suppose, and why have I chosen to focus on his documentaries as opposed to anybody else? Well, I don't really know much about Adam Curtis, beyond the fact that he's worked at the BBC since the early 80s and makes some very good use of archival footage. And he puts together these sometimes mind-bending documentaries that seem to have a kind of metapolitical and kind of zoomed-out view of how on earth we got to the sorry state that we're in today. Now, I don't really care about Curtis's personal politics or how he's described himself, because it is not really that important whether he's left wing or right wing or a progressive or a conservative. Like, I don't really care about all of that. The value of Curtis, in my opinion, is some of the kind of hidden little bits of history that he chooses to highlight and focus on in his documentaries. Now, even though Curtis has got this slightly, like, he'll often go 80% of the way and then he'll leave the extra 20% for, you know, he kind of leaves it open. But that doesn't matter, because while he may not be quote unquote based, we are, of course. So we can kind of, we'll be able to see things that he might miss in his own footage, if that makes any sense. But it's also really interesting as to what he, you know, the sorts of like little hidden episodes in history that he chooses to tease out. And I've started, I mean, a lot of his more well-known documentaries come a lot later than 1988. Probably his first really famous one is The Living Dead in 1995. And even more famous then is The Century of the Self, Power of Nightmares, The Trap, All Washed Over by Machines of Loving Grace. I mean, we'll get to all of those. The early Curtis is different from the later Curtis because, as we'll see in some of the clips I'm going to play, it's a much more conventional documentary style. So the Adam Curtis that most people know and love uses a lot of archival footage with his own narration over the top of the archival footage, and that's it, basically. Okay, so it's archival footage edited together in a clever way, with Curtis kind of linking it all together with his own narrative. This documentary, which was a 7-part series back in 1988 on BBC, and it aired on BBC One. As you'll see, is presented by David Dimbleby. And I did a bit of research on this. I was like, what was the occasion of this documentary? And it seemed like the idea of Britain in decline was somewhat in the ether, because I noticed that ITV had run a series called The Making of Britain that aired, I think, in the same year or maybe a year earlier, with a whole season dedicated to what was called Echoes of Greatness. And there is a book that goes along with that series, okay? And I think that this, An Ocean Apart, was the BBC's answer to the earlier ITV series. And a book was also released of this, written by David Dimbleby, who is the presenter, who we'll see in a second, famous BBC journalist, and a historian called David Reynolds. And I have a feeling that a lot of the material that we see in this is guided by the archival research of this David Reynolds. I suspect that he wrote most of the book as well, and that Dimbleby, you know, maybe helped finesse the prose and, you know, used his name to help to sell the book and the series. But I was having a look around, and apparently David Dimbleby himself used his pull at the BBC to ensure that this documentary was shown on BBC One, not on BBC Two. BBC One is like kind of prime time, big audience numbers. BBC Two is always a little bit more niche. And somehow Dimbleby got this shown on BBC One. The producer is Adam Curtis. And you'll notice that even though this is early Curtis and there is this input by these other people, there are still a lot of signature Adam Curtis kind of touches all over this documentary, especially his extensive use of archival footage, the way he puts sound and music together, and also the way this documentary is teasing out kind of awkward undercurrents that usual mainstream narrative doesn't want you to think about. Okay. I actually think it's quite interesting that the BBC allows him to continue to operate and kind of puts out content like this. And I don't quite understand how that is allowed to happen. But anyway, maybe we'll get answers as we go through. So this first documentary, An Ocean Apart, is interesting, I think, because it focuses on a topic that on Cigar Stream I have been quite interested in over the past, let's say 20 episodes or so. I've been looking at World War II. I've been looking at the dissolution of the British Empire. I've been looking at the Americanization of Britain. I've been looking at a question we keep on asking is, who is to blame for the current state of things? Is it the Americans or is it the British? And this whole documentary, An Ocean Apart, really focuses quite heavily on this question. So it's quite a neat place for us to segue from the regular Cigar Stream that we've been doing into looking at Adam Curtis. So how am I going to go about? Now, later on in this kind of mini-series, and there's probably going to be, this may go all the way until September if everything goes to plan. And I'm going to be joined by guests later in the series, several people like Alexander Adams and Morgoth and Luke and so on have put their names down to, and Pharaoh have said they're interested in appearing on later shows. But as things stand, these first few on Oceans Apart are going to be me on my own. So how am I going to go about reviewing this on my own? First of all, I'll just start by saying that I've only seen these first two episodes, so I haven't seen the complete season yet. I thought the first episode was very strong. I thought it was beautifully put together, poignant. I got a bit emotional at times because it's dealing with World War One. You get to see a lot of a lost past. But there's also quite a mischievous, it's interesting to think about what they're up to in this documentary, because basically they're subtly teasing apart the idea of Britain and America being two separate and indeed opposed nations. There's a lot of focus on Woodrow Wilson and his idealism, but also this contrast between the new world and the old world, which is something that I've talked about before. You know, I have characterized America as an anti-European, anti-traditional power. And this first episode very much leans into that overall thesis, using Woodrow Wilson as a kind of way in. On the other hand, I think a lot of people came into, I mean, let's say watching this channel or being part of our general online sphere, whatever you want to call it, the sensible center, I don't know what you want to call it these days, you know, a group of similarly minded color commentators, you know, the loose affiliate of, you know, vaguely interesting internet personalities, you could call it. A lot of people came into it through libertarianism. So they were very influenced by Murray Rothbard and the Mises Institute and people like that, where Woodrow Wilson is basically Satan. Like, he is absolutely hated by a certain segment of the American conservative right, and more importantly, the libertarian right. They really don't like Wilson for some reason. This documentary, I think, despite highlighting his idealism and his Americanness, I guess you'd call it, I actually think that this episode shows Wilson in a more sympathetic light, painting him as a principled man, an idealistic man, perhaps a little bit brittle, perhaps a little bit kind of intellectual and academic, not very personable, right? But ultimately someone who had his heart in the right place, whose dreams were frustrated by a belligerent and hostile old Europe, right? And I'll play a few, I'm going to play a few little excerpts, you know, before we hit episode two. Clemenceau was focused on, as was Lloyd George, and they were both seen as belligerent, old-fashioned, imperial, you know, kind of bad old European powers against the idealistic New World kind of pacifist Wilson, basically how they kind of presented it, right? It shows Wilson as being basically unwilling to join the First World War until he's absolutely forced to by various clandestine, you know, business interests and old aristocrats and people like that, as we'll see. So that is interesting in itself, that they try to give a picture of a reasonably benign Woodrow Wilson. And I think that some of my American friends, like Ryan Turnipseed and Stephen Carson, that's Radical Liberation, and you know, especially you know, Pete Quinones and a lot of the lads who come from the South, would be, I'd really be interested in know some of their takes on how this documentary presents Wilson. Another really interesting thing that they tease out in this documentary, and another thing that they tease out in this documentary, is of course that America at that time had a very large German population, and it had a very large Irish population, both of whom were hostile to the English and didn't really want to join this war to help the English. And I'm going to show a couple of those interviews, because I think one of the things that makes An Ocean Apart very interesting to watch now is that it has a lot of these talking heads. It has a lot of World War One veterans and survivors and people who were around, because this was 1988. Yes, these people are in their 70s and 80s at this point. Some of them even older, and you'll see some of them are very elderly. But we get to have the first-hand accounts of people who were there. Some of the people were like secretaries of high state, like people who were there in the office of Lloyd George and knew these men personally. Very interesting, I think, just to see it straight from the horse's mouth. But what it does is it kind of shows this contrast between the reality of what a British person of that time was like and what an American person of that time was like, and how, in a way, foreign they were. Okay, and I would say that it's very much... I got a set of books by Winston Churchill here called History of the English Speaking Peoples, okay? And Churchill's whole thing in that book is to try to encourage you to see the British and the Americans as being like family or something like that, to be like one. These are just one people, okay? And this documentary, I feel, is leaning the other way. It's trying to show how actually different they are, how foreign they are, how alien, in a way, the American was to the Brit and the Brit was to the American. Very interesting. And I think a little bit mischievous, which is, again, one of the things that makes Adam Curtis an interesting filmmaker, because he highlights things that are generally a little bit awkward to fit into standard narratives. So let's have a look at how this documentary starts. And I'm actually interested to watch a fair bit of this first. I actually thought episode one was on the whole more interesting than episode two. You know, largely because episode one is about World War One, episode two is about 1920s peacetime. Also lots of interesting material in there. But I think it's worth highlighting some of the bits of this documentary. Hopefully this documentary is old enough that it's not going to get flagged up for copyright for me playing bits of it on this stream. If the stream goes dead, don't go away, just hang about, and it will come back. And obviously I won't be able to play clips. All right, let's just start this, and I'll just show you how the first like 2 minutes starts, and then we'll go later on, okay?
In the autumn of 1916, the British Empire was fighting for survival in the most hideous war of its history. Across the Atlantic, a neutral America looked on. But to pursue the struggle against Germany, Britain was buying huge quantities of arms from America and was running out of dollars to pay for them. In November 1916, the British cabinet was given an ominous warning of what lay ahead. A secret report said that Britain must start borrowing massively in America or face collapse. That report was sent by the Prime Minister to the King at Buckingham Palace. It informed him that his empire, the greatest the world had ever seen, covering a fifth of the globe, was now dependent on a former colony, the United States, for its survival. And that dependence marked the start of Britain's decline and of America's rise to assume Britain's role in the world. It all began that November 1916, when the King and the government realized that power had already started to shift. As the conclusion of the report put it, that America was now in a position to dictate to Britain.
F's in the chat for the British Empire. But interestingly, it starts and it states that, you know, that the power had already swung, you know, by that point. Now, one of the interesting parts of this documentary, as I said, is that it highlights a lot of people who were there who were from, you know, Irish and German backgrounds. And I'm just going to give you like a 10-minute flavor of this because let's start, I don't know, here. Because I think it's cool to see some of these characters, what they were like, how they spoke. Where shall I start it? Maybe here. We'll go like 10 minutes here. If we have copyright issues, I'll just stop and talk a little bit. Okay, let me just play this bit.
One of the things that was vital to him was to get America to help us. Before, she was neutral. The attitude of the whole American state up to this time was neutrality, spelt in big letters, neutrality of the whole nation with a President Wilson who couldn't make up his mind what to do. His attitude was no war.
We take our hats off to you, Mr. Wilson. Our hats are off to you. You're the man of the hour. You stood like a tower. You knew what to do.
The outbreak of war in Europe saw President Wilson urging the people of the United States to stay neutral, to be impartial in thought as well as deed. Wilson believed America's destiny was to remain aloof from the old world. He saw her as an idealistic nation, which should not become embroiled in Europe's conflicts, which so many Americans had fled Europe to escape.
And generally, I would say that all the way through the documentary, they very much characterize Wilson as somebody committed to the new world and not what he thought of as the old world. One of the more interesting aspects of the way that the new and old world are depicted is that the old world is characterized by war, constant fighting, and the new world is characterized as this kind of beacon of hope and peace and trade, right? It's just a peaceful place where people trade. You don't have wars anymore in America. That's very interesting because I remember reading Robert Kagan's Paradise and Power, the neocon manual from 2002, where he was arguing that Europe gets to exist in a postmodern paradise where there's no more war, but America has to engage in the grubby old world of realpolitik and power, so that Europe basically needs to shut up so that it can enjoy its peace as America gets on to be the policeman of the world. And I just think it's really interesting that in the space of 100 years, you've got a complete 180 flip on the narrative, you know. So in the neocon manual, the old world is defined as being a postmodern paradise, characterized by free trade and peace, whereas America has to roll up its sleeve and get involved in war. Whereas here, Wilson thinks of the old world as being characterized by war and America being in this kind of paradise where there's only peace. So it's a complete inversion in the space of 100 years. Let's carry on.
It was a war way across the ocean, places we had never seen. We'd read about them and we had heard about their past experiences, their past wars and fights. And we looked at it as a romantic happening between almost like family members, because you know the British and the German royal families were intertwined there somewhere as cousins or uncles, and we knew that this was so. We'd read about this in school, and we never saw ourselves as part of this.
But American neutrality wasn't allowed to interfere with the tradition.
So I'm going to see if I can get a little bit later where there's this Irish dude. Is it around here? I think this is the German guy. Let's get to him. Because this is kind of interesting that, because basically it makes the point that there are an absolutely shed load of Germans arrived in America in the 19th century. Many of whom have been there, you know, are kind of that was the great first wave of immigration was actually from Germany. So I think America still has a really huge number of people of German stock. So, you know, for Wilson to ask those people to go to, you know, enlist in the army and fight Germans on behalf of the British was a pretty big ask. You know, many of them were like first or second generation at this time as well. Like second generation Germans going back to fight Germans. Anyway, let's play this.
Towns like this. One in every 10 Americans now owed their family allegiance to Germany and its allies.
We all said it's too bad. We felt bad that civilized people would fight each other, but gradually, especially because of the victories, the early victories of the Germans, the people felt proud of the Germans, I would say, even those that hated royalty in Germany. And I suppose this is colored by my own opinion to some extent, but I think most Germans in Nuam were proud of the fact that they were pushing the French and English back.
You hoped that Germany would win?
I suppose, but in a way, I personally didn't want them to win too big. I was afraid that if, you know, the Prussians were pushy. Yeah. They were on the way up, and England and France were on the way down to some extent.
Britain had other enemies in the United States. In the now deserted copper mines of Montana, thousands of Irish Americans were working to satisfy the demands of Britain's war machine. But the miners were helping a country they detested. Committed to Irish independence, they sided with German speakers in opposing support for Britain. President Wilson, aware of these tensions, explained, "We have to be neutral, otherwise our mixed populations would wage war on each other."
St. George's Hall was up on North Main Street. It was up on the corner of Center and Main. And they were having a party for the English Americans. Right down the street, there was the Eagle Bar. Belonged to a big Irishman by the name of Murphy. So when they broke up the party, they're walking down past this Irish pub, you know. But the Irish were just coming out of the bars. They're coming down. They're singing Britannia Rules the Waves. War, right there.
The number of first-generation Irish in Butte at that time was very great, and the patriotic societies among them were quite active in raising money for a planned revolution. And a lot of the young men would go out around the 9 miles south of Butte and drill.
If you ever wonder, by the way, why there was such support for the IRA in America, it's all here. It's all here.
In preparation for the day that they'd be called back to Ireland to participate in a revolution.
Fortunately for her, Britain had more friends than enemies in America. Among them were many of the richest and most powerful. These people, living on the East Coast, were proud of their Anglo-Saxon origins and adopted the way of life of the British upper class. They included the bankers and industrialists, the owners of the mines, steel mills, and power stations, where much of America now worked. Among the most influential of them was J.P. Morgan, a Wall Street banker and friend of Britain's trade minister, W.G. Runciman. Runciman relied on Morgan to help Britain out of her difficulties.
I'm going to carry on playing this because this Runciman chap is astonishingly posh. And he's posh in a manner that we all have to. You don't really see people as posh as this anymore. So,
the Americans were the world's source of supply for electrolytic copper, and this was the most important material of war. My father, he used his friendship with J.P. Morgan, and was able to get in touch with him and say, look, can you buy any electrolytic copper that's marketable for the British government without anybody knowing it's the British government who are trying to buy it. And Morgan said, oh yes, that won't be too difficult. I can put on between 20 and 30 different agents who, they may think they're buying from Morgan's bank, they'll think they're buying also for different people. And so that nobody will think anyone's trying to collar it. And he went on doing this until they'd got something over three quarters of the total supply of stuff available. And that was certainly, I think, due to the fact that Morgan was very pro-British and also being a good banker, and he kept his mouth shut.
Morgan became the official purchasing agent.
So, okay, so it does, it highlights J.P. Morgan's role in getting America on side in the war. It shows the rather large propaganda campaign that was shown in America to persuade Wilson and persuade the people, more importantly, that they should need to be a part of this. Wilson reluctantly is shown to be the kind of reluctantly, you know, he tries to stick by his guns. In fact, this segment here where they show this old film, and this is the sort of thing that Curtis is good at doing, is finding like very forgotten little contemporary bits, like, well, what were people watching at the time? What did the average man on the street think? And yeah, let's watch this next like little 5 minutes here.
Or now made Britain seem little better than her enemy. He wrote, I must admit, I'm at the end of my patience with Great Britain. And the president seemed to be in tune with his people. That summer of 1916, a feature film called Civilization played to packed houses in America. The film tells the story of a mythical kingdom racked by a terrible war. The people rise up and march on the capital to plead with their king and his ministers to stop the slaughter. The film is an allegory of how most of America now felt about the war in Europe. Two kingdoms locked in an insane combat, sacrificing their people for imperial gain. The king rejects his people's pleas. He jails the leader of the protest and visits him in his cell to gloat.
To confess, I've never heard of this film Civilization from 1916, but it seems like this was actually anti-war propaganda. This was basically a plea for the war in Europe to stop and for America not to get involved, to be clear.
The king awakes from his dream a changed man, now determined to put an end to the war. And by the end of 1916, President Wilson, too, was determined to stop the war in Europe. He decided to use America's economic strength to force a conclusion. In November, as Britain tried to raise more funds, he warned American banks not to take up any further loans.
So, yeah, it kind of goes, you know, goes through some of the back and forth here on, you know, Wilson trying to not get involved in the war. I actually think that this bit is quite good, actually. Let's watch this bit where they talk about the American men turning up, the American soldiers turning up in Britain, kind of quite fun. So let's watch this a little bit. But the last bit I want to show is the dude in the cricket ground. We'll watch that as well. But let's see the encounters between the American men and the young British girls who were left behind as their men were fighting in France.
The news went out that the Yanks were coming, and the next thing they were marching through the streets from the docks, and they came our way, Anfield Way, to Long Lawbreck Road. And then I suppose the men were exhausted. They had to stop and have lunch. And it was then that the children would run to meet them, because they gave them whatever they had, you know, candy, as they called it, and that kind of thing. Of course, they had the goodies.
They had a charm about them. No, they were droll in their manner. They were droll, and they still are, incidentally. American men. There's a great attraction to American men.
Mm.
Yeah.
In other words, they had more money, and yes, girls fell for it. Yeah. My sister met this one from Montana, and of course she had to bring him home for my mother to have a look at him, you know. He stated where he came from, Montana, and he's very interested in my sister. He wanted to marry her, he said. And my mother said no. She was too young anyway for a marriage at that time. And then he turned and said he'd take me, and I was only 15 years of age. And my mother told him where to go. Back to Montana.
When we first arrived, we were overcome by the beauty and grandeur of the English cities, the great cathedrals, the beauty of the countryside, and all of these things that fit right in with the image we had with the Empire of Great Britain. This was the home of the Empire, and it fulfilled all of the things that I'd ever read about it. It was beautiful.
This was where one of the places where we, as children, naturally came to play cricket. And when we came here, we were surprised to find the Americans here, particularly with this game of grown-up rounders. To see the great big American soldiers doing this, even the batsmen didn't have a bat, he had something like an Indian club, and he was trying to hit this ball which was thrown bodily at him. Instead of bouncing up to the batsman, it came whizzing at him through the air, and we wondered how on earth he could possibly hit a small ball like this at that pace. We didn't really think much of them as being part of ourselves, because at school, on Empire Day, we sang songs and we thought about India and South Africa and Canada. America was something, wasn't Canada, it was near Canada, but not of us. It was a different world. We didn't think it was their war.
British hopes that America...
So I thought that was a very interesting little clip as well. You know, he said they were not of us, you know, very interesting. So anything else in this first episode I want to highlight? Not really, I don't think. I mean, it's generally speaking, it's pretty interesting. One of the things that the last kind of portion focuses on quite a lot is Woodrow Wilson's 14 points and his vision for you know, the fact that there would be peace without victory, and how idealistic young Europeans looked up to Wilson and kind of saw him as a kind of moral leader, and basically then the process by which that completely degenerated and was torn apart by the European powers, basically, and, you know, the Allies as they were known, and then how you end up with the Treaty of Versailles. Let me just play this little bit of this old woman talking about that, because it captures, I think, again, something which is possibly a little bit forgotten about, which is that in real time, as it was experienced, at the start of the peace process, there was a lot of hope, and there was a lot of kind of almost kind of like utopianism around where this man, Woodrow Wilson, was going to like heal the world or something, setting up the League of Nations, and, you know, the bad old ways were going to be put behind us, and the old world was finally put to rest, and now we could all live in peace and prosperity under the kind of a new way of being. And one of the things I think people forget is that they negotiated and they were talking about what to do for months, you know, 6, 7, 8 months. And over the process, the belligerents, of France and Britain, basically wore Wilson down. And basically it then suggests that the whole thing was giving him like mental health problems and stressing him out. And he gets the flu, and then he has a stroke, and, you know, alienates everybody around him. So they really do portray Wilson as a kind of tragic and flawed man, but ultimately someone who was trying to do the right thing. Let's just play this little bit of this woman who was there in the crowd as 17, 18 year old.
And to apply the principles for which he said he fought. What was to be the effect of his coming upon us this morning? We, who flushed with victory, meant to insist on terms for peace which had no justification in our war aims, and which were based not on brotherly love or international peace, but on revenge on our enemies, distrust of our allies, and a determination for swag. We are going into these negotiations with our mouths full of fine phrases, and our brains seething with dark thoughts.
They must have asked for volunteers to take wounded soldiers to the courtyard of Buckingham Palace, and I was one.
So I think it's actually a little bit earlier, this moment where they all go to this. They all go. I can't find it now. Or is it here? I don't know. Maybe here. There's a moment where Wilson turns up in Paris. I think it might be here, actually. Wilson goes to Paris, and there's a huge crowd to welcome him and so on. Maybe it's here. Let's have a look.
But eternal peace. There was about us the halo of some divine mission. We of the British delegation made our home at the Hotel Majestic, a name which brings back to me memories of that incessant dance music with which Foreign Office clerks and typists fought the boredom of the next 6 months.
Almost at once, the difficulties began to emerge, and it was obvious that Clemenceau was as stubborn as Wilson, and Lloyd George wouldn't move very much either.
Wilson soon discovered.
Unfortunately, I can't find that particular bit that I'm talking about. But anyway, that's the basic gist of it. Generally, very interesting documentary. I think its biggest value is in seeing the sorts of characters who were there, what they were like, and some of their kind of real human impressions. In terms of its depiction of Wilson, I'm sure that there'll be people who will be able to poke holes in it. Obviously, the role of a certain group are not highlighted at all, for obvious reasons. There's Clemenceau, who's seen as a very stubborn old bastard. That's episode one. And then episode two then looks at the post-war, life in the 1920s. And it basically follows a very specific thesis, which is that Herbert Hoover, who is chosen as the hero slash villain of this particular episode, had this vision of basically taking over the British Empire using stealthy commercial tactics, i.e. trying to inherit the trade network of the old British Empire. And the whole episode basically looks at all of the sneaky and cunning ways that the Americans used to either buy up or circumvent the structures of the British Empire, including taking over the electricity grid of Britain itself, getting around tariffs by building factories in Britain itself, and various other stratagems. There's a long section where they look at this guy, Firestone, who was a tire manufacturer. And it looks like there's also quite a lot of Henry Ford in this episode as a kind of titan of industry and as a kind of a symbol of the spirit of America at this time. It follows this Firestone basically establishing a massive rubber plantation in Liberia. And there's a kind of funny moment where Marcus Garvey and the kind of black nationalists are massively fucked over by the American government, basically helped out by Herbert Hoover, basically doing a bit of neo kind of shadow colonialism to help Firestone start a rubber plantation. But the whole point of it is that British controlled all of the raw materials. Okay, so America was doing a lot of manufacturing, but a lot of the raw materials were still made in the British Empire, including rubber, including basically any of the raw materials you can think of. And so that, you know, they zoom in on this, the British Empire had a 33% tariff on incoming goods. So they were, you know, they still basically controlled global trade at this time. So, you know, one of the methods they used to get around it was basically like setting up their own plantations so they wouldn't have to rely on Britain for imports for raw materials. The second thing they did is that they bought up a lot of the old factories in Britain. And there's even evidence shown in this of using British people as a front. Okay, so the company looks British and all the paperwork, but actually it's a front for an American tycoon who's sneakily buying up the business and, you know, for America against Britain under their noses. Okay. So there's a lot of like stealthy stuff like that that is highlighted in this one. They look at General Electric and they look at there's Hoover. They also look at how fashion trends were being driven at this time. And I thought this was one of the more interesting segments of this one. I'll start it here with Dimbleby in the cinema. And we'll go through and they look at makeup as well. So let's have a look at this bit.
Responsible for promoting American exports. The challenge was to break through into world trade. Hoover made no bones about wanting America to become the richest country the world had ever seen. But it wasn't entirely for selfish reasons. Like President Wilson when he took America into the Great War, Hoover believed that the United States had a moral duty to use her strength to reform the old world. And he believed the way of doing it was through trade. If there could be economic cooperation instead of the...
Thanks for reforming the old world, America. Now, 100 years later, we're all so grateful. Thank you, Herbert Hoover. Thank you.
rivalries of the old empires, then there was a chance of avoiding another war. But first, America had to prise open the door into these markets, of which the most powerful was Britain and her empire. It's no coincidence that one of the first of the trade bureaus set up by Hoover dealt with the movie industry. Hoover believed that American films would sell American goods. His allies were the people who came week after week to cinemas like this.
So did you hear that? The reason they wanted to push cinema into foreign markets was as a covert advert. I'd never heard that before. That the real reason the movies were there wasn't to export like just ideology. It was so that people could see American stuff on the big screen and say, I want to be like that too. I want that too. Very, very interesting.
British people dreaming American dreams.
I used to look on all things American with starry eyes. So when I heard these American shoes had got into this shop in Tottenham Court Road, which was quite a long way from Bow, I decided to go and get a pair. But when I got to the shop for these American shoes, there was a queue. And I'd never seen a queue in my life before, and I don't think anybody else had. But I went in and I tried on these shoes. They looked beautiful. They were patent, which meant they shone. And if you had them on, everybody knew you had a pair of American shoes on, because nobody else was making them except Americans. Everything that came from America at that time was good. I won't say it's still good, but it was then. You sort of had the idea that if it came from America, it had to be good. It was good.
It wasn't long before the manufacturers of the products seen in the films started arriving in Britain. In 1927, Max Factor opened his first shop in London, selling what became known as the American look.
Film star makeup came as an absolute revolution, of course, to this country. They'd already got to know it a bit in America, and then suddenly Max Factor was on the doorstep here and in the shops, and with the most wonderful advertising.
I do find it interesting that, you know, a massive American import is literally women putting on a fake face. It's just very interesting, very interesting.
Advertising campaign imaginable. In every paper and magazine you picked up, this little coupon that was open for everybody to fill in and send off and get their Max Factor chart, you see, which was a film star chart virtually. And this revolutionized makeup. Nothing of this had ever been done before, and here it was suddenly available to you to go and buy in the shops.
I'd be lost without my Glowbait, because without clogging my pores, it allows my skin to breathe just as though it weren't there, and keeps my makeup intact for hours.
Notice, by the way, that the strategy of America in general always been to go after the women first. You win the women over through all of this bullshit. And then you've got them. Once you've got the women, you've got them. You've got the whole society. Classic kind of psyops.
This is very important to all of us women, because the only time that we're not on parade is the time we spend in front of our dressing tables. Sometimes not even then.
What had people had before?
This, and they'd probably put that in a powder box like that and plonked it on their face, and that virtually was all some women used.
And now my lipstick.
As long as it was a town that had a chemist shop, you could get it. You could get it.
And it worked?
And it worked. Of course it worked, because the girls and the women of that town were going to the cinema every week. And of course it worked. And it was the cosmetics of the stars. That's how we advertised, the cosmetics of the stars. It was glamour. And it was American.
Oh dear. Okay, so there was there's that. Now we get into this whole thing with the You know, these are some images of Henry Ford, kind of interesting footage of Henry Ford and his some of his mates. And it looks at, you know, all of the different strategies that were used to get around the restrictions that the British Empire was trying to, because the British weren't stupid. They knew what the Americans were up to, right? So they tried to use like tariffs and various other strategies to keep them out. And, you know, Henry Ford opened up this massive car plant in Dagenham. It's still there, by the way. So he just went around it just by being like, okay, if you're going to tax my cars coming in through tariffs, I'll just make them there. How are you going to stop me now? So that was his strategy of doing it. The Firestone one was to get around the tariffs by opening up his own raw material plantation in Liberia, right? Which is this whole bit here. So this is telling the story of that. In fact, I'll show this funny bit of Marcus Garvey's secretary and some of the mud huts and things. You might like this bit. Let's play this bit.
For rubber planting.
In 1925, Firestone came to Liberia. Fearful of the monopoly Europe held with its domination of the Far Eastern plantations, they eagerly sought a new land that could grow rubber. Here was abundant rainfall. Here was a soil that for centuries had proved its ability to support tree crops. And here were a government and a people seeking a solution to self-improvement. There were no blueprints for these pioneering rubber growers as they established contact with the village people.
But Firestone was not the only one with designs on Liberia. The country had been founded by American philanthropists as a homeland for freed African slaves. And the American black nationalist Marcus Garvey, founder of the United Negro Improvement Association, wanted to settle there too. Garvey had been negotiating with the Liberian government to come to Liberia with 500,000 followers.
Why didn't they let him? Why did they not let him do that? That would have been so good if Marcus Garvey had led an exodus out of America. Why did that not happen? Anyway, let's carry on.
Hundreds of acres of land were ceded to us as for development. And there was no question about it. We thought that the thing was sealed until forces in the United States of America, the Firestone interests and others, they got together with Herbert Hoover, who was then the Secretary of Commerce, protecting the interests of American business. Our problem started then.
The Liberian government were anxious to raise...
Look at that, though. They could have got rid of... I say got rid of. They could have liberated, okay? They could have liberated almost a million... African Americans from the oppressive structures of racist old America. Instead, they fucked them over and opened a rubber plantation. I mean, you can't make it up.
Loans and investment from American banks, but reluctant to put their country in Firestone's hands. Firestone, knowing the determination of the American government to outmaneuver the British, turned to the president for help. Confidential State Department cables reveal the pressure now put on Liberia. They offered military assistance and advisers to help handle Firestone's investment, but warned Liberia of the dangers of refusing.
So another thing they look at is the British government's attempts to... let's watch this bit with a map, and I'll tell you why. Because I wish that all BBC programming was this segment right here with Dimbleby, with the two globes and the map. If all BBC programming was like this, I would just compulsively watch it all the time. This is what the BBC could be, is David Dimbleby in this room with a massive map in front of him and two globes. This is my ideal vision of the BBC coming up. Let's just play it.
Britain.
The Liberian experiment was a striking example of the lengths to which America was prepared to go to break Britain's stranglehold on world trade. But it was by no means unique. During the 1920s, American companies bought up British interests in raw materials right round the world, everything from tin and copper to manganese and nitrate. Americans with plenty of money to spend were determined that their expansion shouldn't be held back by Britain. Though America was the world's richest country, the British Empire was by no means on her knees. Britain ruled over a fifth of the Earth's surface, and to protect her interests, she stopped trading competitors getting in by putting up tariff barriers or duties on anyone trying to sell within this magic circle. Thrusting American businessmen soon found a way around that one too. In order to avoid paying the tariffs, they started operating from inside them. They began to set up companies to produce from the very heart of the British Empire.
That was a base segment because it has a big map, big gestures, pointing at the map. If British TV was just posh British men pointing at maps in an authoritative manner, it would be the best thing ever. Anyway, so it shows Henry Ford setting up this plant in Dagenham. There's a soap factory that's set up. Firestone, we talked about as well. One of the things I wanted to have a look at here was they show music coming over, American style jazz. Ugh. Can't blame Henry Ford for that one. And various other things that were going on. So there's a massive influx, basically, of kind of American influence. This bit actually talks about some of the pushback that was coming out of the press and some of the MPs and the people around this time who thought there was too much of an American takeover happening in the 20s here. I'll just play this little bit.
The sad truth is that the majority of our population now talk America, think America, dream America. They have, to all intent and purpose, become temporary American citizens. The blame for all this was put on American films. To limit their influence, Parliament introduced a Film Act. In future, a quota of all films shown in Britain would have to be made in Britain. But American filmmakers weren't so easily seen off. They set up their own British studios to make what they cynically called quota quickies.
Quota quickies were made by American companies.
I want a Wikipedia check on this dude. I believe that this is the first, let's just say, American of this stripe that we've seen so far in the whole documentary. Interesting, it's about movies. Let's see what he thought of the attempts by the British to keep American films from the public.
To satisfy the British law, which had decided that a certain proportion of pictures shown in the British market were made by British film producers. So the Americans decided to satisfy the law by making those pictures in Britain. They had no intention of showing them in America.
What were they like?
Fortunately, I saw very few of them.
Well, I'm going to tell you. I believe in Reggie, but he's been allowed to drift away his life. No one has ever given him any go, any pep.
The quota quickies are actually a little kind of, you know how I get interested in things once in a while. I went through a period of being really interested in quota quickies because, they're just kind of interesting. I got into the films of Powell and Pressburger at one time, and Michael Powell, one half of Powell and Pressburger, made a ton of these quota quickies in the start of his career. And this one, Lazy Bones, is actually by Michael Powell, who we'll see in a moment. So this is of interest to me personally.
Yes.
Why waste money on a picture which is only going to be seen by a limited number of local people, so to speak?
Excuse me. Opening time.
Quota quickies were made on the cheap. Lazy Bones, a typical quickie, was filmed at night. The sets borrowed from films being made during the day. The actors were moonlighting too, arriving after they'd finished their evening's performance in the London theatre.
They actually gave a show on the, in the West End. Then they got into a car and were brought down to Twickenham. Then, because the union insisted on it, everybody immediately sat down to an enormous dinner, roast beef and potatoes and all the right things to eat when you're just going to play a romantic scene.
Will you marry me, Kitty?
Well, Reggie, I don't know.
It was a real killer from the point of view of an ambitious young director like I was.
Quota quickies became notorious. Many were shown in empty cinemas to the cleaners, simply to fulfil the quota. Newspapers complained that the Americans were destroying the British film industry.
I don't think it was destroying the British film industry. Dominating, yes. It was dominating for the simple reason that the pictures the Americans were making appealed more to the British movie-going public than their own pictures were.
Look at this piece of shit. They just outlined the tactic of making these quota quickies by, you know, Americans basically making the films in Britain, making them of appallingly low quality on a really struishing budget, crowding out the space. So, of course, next to that, the American films are going to look better. What an absolute piece of work. Come on.
So in that respect, they were dominating. Do I feel guilty of that? Why should I feel guilty?
Of course, you'd never feel guilty, would you, mate? He'd never feel guilty. There he is, look, laughing at you.
In 1928, Herbert Hoover exchanged the Department of Commerce for the presidency of the United States. In less than 10 years, he'd seen an...
So the last bit I wanted to show was this bit now where Dimbleby quotes from this book, which I hear this quote and it was so perfect, I immediately bought the book at some expense to myself. But I knew that once I'd shown this, there'd be a rush from all of you guys to try to get this book as well. Quite extraordinary. It's a book called America Conquers Britain, and they basically lay out the whole plan right here. So let's watch this like next 5 minutes, and then we'll wrap up for the night. Okay.
The organization, he said, is British. When he bought the companies, Clark put British politicians on the board. Why did he do that?
Very common practice and very worthwhile. You need local support, integration and so on. If you go to drill a silver mine in Mexico, you add some Mexicans. It's just done worldwide, has been for centuries. You weren't able to handle silver miners very well if you didn't have somebody there, a native, to talk to them. Now, he might have been a well-heeled native, but he understood the language.
Dark, dark practices from the Americans here. Dark.
In the 20s, the electrical industry in Britain was expanding. New power stations and the factories that went with them were being built along London's river and around every major city in Britain. But in 1929, the truth about electricity came out. The American involvement was far greater than anyone had suspected. First, it emerged that General Electric of America, not content with what they'd already bought, had acquired over half the last remaining big electrical company, which in a panic tried to deny the Americans their voting rights. Then, just 2 weeks later, the facts about AEI came out, that it was wholly American-owned. And finally, the electricity commissioners in charge of Britain's grid system revealed that the Americans were buying up Britain's power stations too, and warned that they were siphoning off the profits from Britain back to the United States. America Conquers Britain was the title of a bestseller at the time. Its American author concluded, "We were Britain's colony once. She will be our colony before she's done. Not in name, but in fact. But we shan't make Britain's mistake. Too wise to govern the world, we shall merely own it. Nothing can stop us. Nothing.
until our financial empire rots at its heart, as empires have a way of doing. What chance has Britain against America?
Basically perfect quotation, basically perfectly lays out everything that I've said about Britain being a colony. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal. In fact, it's so good, that quote, I want to play it again. So let's listen to it again. Let's listen to it again.
About electricity came out. The American involvement was far greater than anyone had suspected. First, it emerged that General Electric of America, not content with what they'd already bought, had acquired over half the last remaining big electrical company, which in a panic tried to deny the Americans their voting rights. Then, just 2 weeks later, the facts about AEI came out, that it was wholly American-owned. And finally, the electricity commissioners in charge of Britain's grid system revealed that the Americans were buying up Britain's power stations too, and warned that they were siphoning off the profits from Britain back to the United States. America Conquers Britain was the title of a bestseller at the time. Its American author concluded, "We were Britain's colony once. She will be our colony before she's done. Not in name, but in fact. But we shan't make Britain's mistake. Too wise to govern the world, we shall merely own it. Nothing can stop us. Nothing. Until our financial empire rots at its heart, as empires have a way of doing. What chance has Britain against America?"
I mean, it's basically a Bond villain speech or something, isn't it? It's just quite incredible, that. I can't wait to see what else is in that book, because that is an absolutely killer quote. I will just say that the last thing that is really funny about this series is that it's sponsored by, it has a sponsor. Let's have a look at the sponsor.
An Ocean Apart is made possible in part by British Airways, serving North America to London and beyond.
For some reason, I found it pretty funny that the whole documentary's got like sponsors in an American accent, and they're trying to flog you trips to America as well, on top of it all. That was funny. Kind of an interesting and forgotten bit of history, this, which, you know, I'd certainly recommend it. I think episode one was a little bit, better than episode two, if I'm honest. But I do think that the things that episode two uncover, which are the underhanded American methods of gaining a foothold and overtaking the British Empire during the 1920s, and just how much skullduggery and fuckery there was, is very interesting, kind of hidden history, really. It's not something that you're taught about. It's not something you're encouraged to think about. A lot of the names that we know, you know, sneakily were American businesses in the first place, which are, again, very, very covert and cunning methods. So anyway, next week we're going to be watching, let me just have a look at my master list here. I'm going to pull up my master list to see what okay, so next week it's just the next two episodes, episodes 3 and 4. I think An Ocean Apart gets all the way to Thatcher and Reagan. Okay, so it's it really is a kind of dual study of Britain and America side by side, how Britain loses the empire, how America gains its empire, and also, I think, along the way, how Britain is Americanized increasingly. What's interesting about these first two episodes is just how early the process starts, right? I mean, it's literally, it declares at the start the British Empire was basically done by 1916. And by the end of the 1920s, America has successfully bought up all the businesses from underneath it, muscled its way into global trade, undercut and undermined the British Empire, and started Americanizing the minds and psyoping the British public in the 1920s. That's a lot earlier than most people would think about that whole process, so anyway, we will see where this goes. Obviously there's the 1930s and the Depression, and I'm guessing the Second World War will be the next two episodes. Should be very interesting. I'll just remind everybody that you can buy courses at the Academic Agency. Trivium, like I advertised at the top, is the top seller there. Psalm 153 says, refreshing documentaries. I can't wait to see where these go. Well, thank you very much, Psalm 153. It means so much. And Curtis produces lots of interesting things. There's one little enduring Curtis theme that is sprinkled into this second episode that we were watching bits from just now. And that is increasing rationality of a mechanized capitalist society. And one of the things that they talk about when the Americans took over the factories is they were like, not enough of this stuff was automated, right? So they wanted to, the Americans massively increased the number of processes that were automated, and increasingly started to see human beings according to a rational calculation model, right? Kind of proto Chicago school stuff. And this is one of Adam Curtis's absolute obsessions. And it's first hinted at here, which is interesting. So he's definitely going to focus on that in a number of other documentaries as well. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this. I will see you tomorrow night for Unpopular Opinions. We've got Dan from Brokenomics, Lotus Eater, on, as well as my good buddy Chris Gard, as well as Mr. D. That'll be tomorrow night. But for now, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.
It's over.